This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
One of the things that's quite characteristic about people, especially if they're introverted and they don't have very many friends, they don't have people to talk to, if they're suffering, maybe they're depressed or anxious, or they have some sets of strange symptoms like agoraphobia or obsessive compulsive disorder, one of the things they always presume that is that the fact that they're suffering in that manner means that there's something, not only something wrong with them, but something uniquely wrong with them, so that it's their fault and no one else is like them. And one of the things you do as a diagnostician, you know, you'll hear a lot of rattling about how labeling is bad for people, and certainly mislabeling is bad for people, and even an accurate label can be a box that you can't get out of. But it's very, very frequently the case that if you diagnose someone, it's a relief to them, like you can't believe, because they come in to see you knowing that something isn't going properly, but they think, well, they're the only person facing it, and that means they're idiosyncratically strange in some incomprehensible way that no one else could possibly understand, and there's no way they could ever get better. And one of the things you do is point out to them is like, yeah, depression and anxiety doesn't really require any explanation, right? There's plenty of reason. I don't remember who said it. Everyone has sufficient justification for suicide. I think that was the claim. Well, but the point is that if you look through the experiences of the typical person, unless they're very, very fortunate, and they won't be that way forever, that's certainly the case, that they can point to traumatic experiences in their life, death and loss and illness and humiliation and all those sorts of things, that are sufficient to account for existence in a state of quasi-permanent negative emotion. Now, often if you see, as I said, if you see people who are depressed and anxious by nature, they assume that everyone else is the smiling face that you see on Facebook, and so that alienates them from other people and themselves even more than certainly far more than necessary. And part of the psychoeducation that goes along with therapy is merely educating people to understand that a fair bit of misery is the norm, and that there's plenty of genuine reason for it. Go somewhere you don't understand. That's the first thing. Get thee out of thy country. You know, back in the 1920s, there was a whole slew of American writers who ended up as expatriates in Paris, Hemingway among them, and who wrote The Great Gatsby. Fitzgerald, yes, and a variety of others. It was very inexpensive in Paris at the time, and part of their transformation into great literary figures was the fact that they were out of their country, and now they could see what their country was, because you can't see what your country is until you leave it. So you have to go into the unknown, and that's God's first command. Go into the unknown, because you already know what you know. And that's not enough unless you think you're enough. And if you're not enough and you don't think you're enough, then you have to go where you haven't been. And so that's the first commandment to Abraham. It's like, okay, that's a good one. That makes perfect sense. Go to where you don't know. Yes. And from thy kindred. Well, what does that mean? It means grow up, right? That's what it means. It means get away from your family enough so that you can establish your independence. And that isn't because there's something wrong with your family, although perhaps there is, you know, as there is perhaps wrong with you. But it means get away, you know. I talk to people very frequently whose families have provided them with too much protection, and they know it themselves, and that means they're deprived of necessity. You know, one of the things that you see in the United States, for example, is that the children of first-generation immigrants often do better than their children. And the reason for that is that the children of first-generation immigrants have necessity driving them. And you don't know how much you need necessity to drive you, because maybe you're not very disciplined. And if and a catastrophe doesn't immediately befall you if you don't act forthrightly today, then maybe you never act forthrightly, right? Because the gap between your foolishness and the punishment is lengthened by your unearned wealth. And so you never grow up and learn, and you have to get yourself away from your dependency in order to allow necessity to drive you forward.
And that's to become independent and to become mature. And I think part of what's happening in our culture is that the force that's attacking the forthright movement forward of young men in particular is afraid of the power of men because it's confused about the distinction between power and authority and competence. Like a man who has authority and competence has power as a byproduct, but the authority and competence is everything. And people who can't understand that fail to make the distinction between power and authority and competence, and they're afraid of power, and so they destroy authority and competence. And that's a terrible thing because we need authority and competence. What else is going to allow us to prevail in the long run? And so you get away from your country and you get away from your kin and from your father's house, right? And you go out there and you establish yourself in the world. It's a call to adventure. That's what the first lines in the Abrahamic story is, a call to adventure. So, great, unto a land that I will show you. Well, you know, what does that mean? You know, one of the things that I've been struck very hard by a number of writers, Carl Jung, obviously among them. I mean, he wrote things like Nietzsche that if you understand them, they just break you into pieces, you know? And one of the things that Jung understood and the psychoanalysts understand, it's one of the most terrifying elements of psychoanalytic thinking. It's very tightly allied with religious thinking, which is that you are not the master of your own house. There are spirits that dwell in you, within you, meaning you have a will and you can exercise a certain amount of conscious control over your being, but there are all sorts of things that occur within you that seem to be beyond your capacity to control. Your dreams, for example, that's a really good example, or your impulses, for example, you might think of those as so foreign from you that they're not even, you don't even want them to be part of you. But more subtly even, how about what you're interested in, what compels you? Like, where does that come from? Exactly. Because you can't conjure it up of your own accord, you know? So if you're a student and you're taking a difficult course, you might say to yourself, well, I need to sit down and study for 3 hours. But then you sit down and that isn't what happens. Your attention goes everywhere. And you might say, well, whose attention is it then if it goes everywhere? Because you say it's your attention. It's like, well, if it's your attention, maybe you would be able to control it, but you can't. And so then you might think, well, Jen, just exactly what the hell is controlling it? And you might say, well, it's random. Well, it better not be random. I can tell you that. That happens to some degree in schizophrenia. There's an element of randomness in that. It's not random. It's driven by the action of phenomena that I think are best considered as something like subpersonalities, although even that's only a partial description. You can't make yourself interested in something. Interest manifests itself and grips you. That's a whole different thing. And so what is it that's gripping you? And how do you conceptualize that? Is that a divine power? Well, it's divine as far as you're concerned because it grips you and you can't do anything about it. And so there's a calling in you towards what you're compelled by and what you're interested in. And sometimes that might be very dark and sometimes not. But you're compelled forward by your interest. And so the idea that what moves you away from your country and your father's house and the comforts of your childhood home is something that's beyond you and that you listen to and hearken to. That's exactly right. And you can say, well, I don't want to call that God. It's like, it doesn't matter what you call it exactly. It doesn't matter to what it is, what it's called. It still is. And if you don't listen to it, that's the other thing. If you don't listen to it, and I've been a clinician and talked to enough people now, as old as I am, to know this absolutely. If you do not listen to that thing that beckons you forward, you will pay for it like you cannot possibly imagine. You'll have everything that's terrible about life in your life and nothing about it that's good. And worse, you'll know that it was your fault and that you squandered what you could have had. So, this is not only a calling forth, but a warning. Unto a land that I will show thee, and that's it, that I will show thee. That, and you don't want to be too concrete about this, you know. There's all sorts of new territories that you can inhabit. there's this abstract and conceptual territories. If you go to university and you study biology or you study physics or any discipline, you're in a territory, right? You're in the territory that all the scholars have established. And then as you master the discipline, you move out beyond the established territory into the unknown. And that's a new land, right? Maybe it's even a land of your enemies, for that matter. But it's a new land. The frontier is always in front of you. And so, you know, when the earth was less inhabited than it is now, the frontier was, the psychological frontier and the geographical frontier was the same thing. And now they've separated to some degree because there's not so much geographical frontier. But there's, the frontier is a place that never disappears. And the land that's beyond the land that you know is always there. And it's always where you should go. And all of that's packed into these, what, four phrases. So when I've been thinking about narrative, you look at the world through a story. You can't help it. And the story is what gives value to the world, or the story is what you extract from the value of the world. You can look at it either way. You're somewhere and it's not good enough, right? That's the eternal human predicament. Wherever you are isn't good enough. And to some degree, that's actually a good thing, because if it was good enough, well, there's nothing for you to do. So it's actually maybe a good thing that it's insufficient. And that might be why sometimes having less is better than having more. And I don't want to be a Pollyanna about that. I mean, I know that there's deprivation that can reach to the point where it's completely counterproductive. But it isn't always the case that starting with little is... If you start with little, you start with more possibility. It's something like that. So you move from what's unbearable about the present to some better future, right? And if you don't have that, then you have nothing but threat and a negative emotion. You have no positive emotion, because the positive emotion is generated in the conception of the better future and then the evidence that you generate yourself that you're moving towards it. That's where the positive and fulfilling meaning of life comes. So you want to set up this structure properly. It's very, very important. And so what it means is that you want to be going somewhere that's good enough so that the going is worth the while. And you can ask yourself that, and that's partly what we tried to build into the future authoring program, which is, well, we know what's wrong with life. It's rife with suffering and insufficiency and deception and evil. It's all of that, obviously. Okay, what would make the journey worthwhile? Well, you can ask yourself that. It's like, all right, in order to bear up under this load, what is it that I would need to be striving to attain? And if you ask yourself that, that's to knock and the door will open. That's what that means. If you ask yourself that, then you will find an answer, and you'll think, you'll shrink away from it. You'll think, well, there's no way I could do that. It's like, well, you don't know what you could do. You don't know what's possible. And you're not as much as you could be. And so God only knows what you could do and have and give if you sacrificed everything to it. And that's the reason Abraham is constantly making sacrifices. And it's archaic, right? He's burning up like baby lambs. But like, well, they're alive. You know, that's something. And they're valuable, and that's something. It's, you have to admit, even if you think about it as a modern person, that the act of sacrificing something might have some dramatic compulsion to it. You know, to go out into a flock and to take something that's newborn and to cut its throat and to bleed it and to burn it might be a way of indicating to yourself that you're actually serious about something. And it isn't so obvious that we have rituals of seriousness like that now. And so it's not so obvious that we're actually serious about anything. And so maybe that's not such a good thing. And so maybe we shouldn't be thinking that these people were so archaic and primitive and superstitious. It's possible that they knew something that we don't. And certainly in the Abrahamic stories, one of the things that maintains Abraham's covenant with God is his continual willingness to sacrifice. It's so, that sacrificial issue is so important, because you are not committed to something unless you're willing to sacrifice for it. Commitment and sacrifice are the same thing. And I think it borders on miraculous that those concepts are embedded into this narrative at the level of dramatic action, you know, instead of abstract explanation. People are acting this out.
Hey, what's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays? Decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa? Got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments? Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels? Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Out, and the fundamental conception is so profound that it's really quite awe-inspiring. It's breathtaking, really, when you understand what message is trying to be conveyed. You have to make sacrifices, and what do you have to sacrifice? You have to sacrifice that which is most valuable to you currently that's stopping you. And God only knows what that is. It's certainly the worst of you. It's certainly that. And God only knows to what degree you're in love with the worst of you.
You got to know that there are differences in intelligence. It's really important. If you go into a job and you're not smart enough for that job, you're going to have one bloody miserable time. And you're going to make life wretched for the people around you because you won't be able to handle the position. And as you climb hierarchies of competence, the demand on fluid intelligence increases. And so, unless you want to fail, you don't put yourself in over your head. Well, what's over your head? Well, that's a tricky thing to figure out. I mean, you have to figure that out with intelligence, you have to figure it out with conscientiousness, you have to figure it out with creativity, you have to figure it out with stress tolerance, with agreeableness, because you want to go into a cooperative environment and not a competitive one if you're agreeable, and with neuroticism, you probably want to keep the stress level of your job relatively low, because those are all places that you can break down. And most people have at least one significant weakness in their intelligence personality makeup, and you got to be careful not to place yourself in a position where that's going to be a fatal flaw. But what you really want to do, as far as I can tell, if you want to maximize your chances for both success and let's say well-being, is you want to find a strata of occupation in which you would have an intelligence that would put you in the upper quartile. That's perfect. Then you're a big fish in a small pond. And you don't want to be the stupidest guy in the room. It's a bloody rough place to be. So, and you probably don't want to be the smartest guy in the room either, because what that probably means is you should be in a different room, right? You should look at a place where if you're right at the top, you've mastered it. It's time to go somewhere where you're a little lower so that you've got something to climb up for. So, and I can, if you're not hyper-conscientious, for example, you're probably not going to want a job that you have to work 70 hours a week at, because you're just not wired up that way. You'd rather have some leisure and, like, more power to you. If that's how you're wired up, there's nothing wrong with having some leisure. But if you're someone who can't stand sitting around doing nothing ever, then maybe you can go into a job that's going to require you to work 75 hours a week. And almost all jobs that are at the top of complex dominance hierarchies require very high intelligence and insane levels of conscientiousness, as well, generally speaking, as pretty damn high levels of stress tolerance, you know, because that can knock you out too, because there's going to be sharp fluctuations in your career, generally speaking, at the higher levels of a structure, and you have to make very complicated decisions, often with very short time horizons. So you have to decide if that's what you want. You know what that's like. You know exactly what that's like. You have to master a new skill, but you're avoiding it because you know that you'll be bad at it when you first do it. And if you're perfectionistic, you're going to say, well, I can't allow myself to be bad at anything. I can't allow myself to be a fool. And no wonder. But the problem is when you try something new, you're always a fool. And so unless you're willing to be a fool, you can't learn anything new. And that's also why Jung regarded the trickster as the precursor to the savior, archetypally speaking, is because you cannot do the right thing unless you're willing to be a fool first. And that's really worth knowing. Lots of times, you guys, you're going to make a stage transition in your life, and you're going to feel like an imposter. When you get a new job, or when you get a promotion or something like that, you're going to feel like an imposter. And you are. Because what do you know when you make that first transition, right? But it's going to make you embarrassed, and it's going to make you ashamed, and all of those things. But you have to understand that you are a fool when you first try something new. But you're a worse fool if you don't try it. Now, that doesn't mean you should, you know, make like you know everything as soon as you're promoted or you have some transition in status. That's foolish, of the wrong sort. But to know that you have to be fallible in order to progress is an unbelievably useful thing. It can free you up. You know, I was talking to a writer the other day about his process for beginning writing. He's written many books. He writes a very, very, very bad first draft, Right, and that's a good way to think about things, is throughout your life you're going to be doing that, is writing the next draft of you, and it's pretty bad to begin with. But that's okay, because it isn't going to get any better unless you put yourself out into the domain of the unknown to begin with. And, you know, it might go badly. I mean, that's what happens here.
You know, that's the human being. Lips, tongues, hands, and the face. Your face is also extraordinarily amenable to voluntary manipulation. So you can learn to move single neurons in the tissue underneath your eyes. That's how high resolution your face is. And that's partly because it's a broadcast screen, which is why people are always looking at it, right? And that's why if you watch a movie, it's always concentrating on people's faces, is because they're just broadcasting what? They're broadcasting their stories constantly. And we're looking at their faces. What are you looking at? What are your eyes pointing at? What are you up to? What's your emotional expression? What are you going to do next? What do you think about me? Where are you going? And you're broad, like, you find someone who has had too much plastic surgery uncanny, because their face is dead, because you cannot tell what they're up to. They've got this zombie-like aspect that's terrifying. And people like that, look, people like that got killed. That's why we're not like that. Or they didn't mate. It's like, you want to know what that other person is up to. And I told you already, that's how the whites of our eyes evolved, right? Do you remember that story? Gorillas don't have that distinction between the iris and the whites, not like human beings. And our eyes are very sharp. And one thing we really want to know is, what are you looking at and why? What are you up to? And if I can tell what you're looking at, I can infer what you're going to do. And you want to broadcast that. Well, except when you don't want to broadcast it. But, you know, most of the time you want to be pretty transparent to other people, because otherwise they won't trust you. And if they don't trust you, they won't cooperate with you. They won't compete with you. And the probability that they'll come after you is extraordinarily high, because you'll be evil predator in no time flat. So, what are you doing in class? Why aren't you, like, drinking vodka and snorting cocaine? You know, because you could be doing that. Instead, here you are, listening to me, you know, slaving away in university. You're young. It's like, really? You've got nothing better to do than sit there? You know, well, what you're willing to forego today's pleasure for tomorrow's advantage. And that's what sacrifice is. And human beings discovered that dramatically first, you know, like we were apes, for God's sake. We didn't just leap up and think, oh, we better save for tomorrow. You know, it took thousands of years for that idea to emerge. And it emerged in dramatic form. And it was sort of like, well, society is sort of like a god. No, they weren't thinking this through. It was like, if you're going to represent society, well, it's like this masculine god that's always judging the hell out of you, that's everywhere all at the same time. It's like, yeah, that's true, absolutely. And what do you have to do with it? Well, you have to give it what it wants. Why do you have to give it what it wants? Because it'll crush you if you don't. And that's exactly right. And if you're lucky and you give it the right sacrifice, then it'll smile on you and you get to have a good life. And that was the major discovery of mankind, man. That was a killer discovery. It was like the discovery of the future. You know, we discovered the future as a place. And it was a place that you could bargain with. You can bargain with the future. Wow, that's just, what an idea that is. You know, it's so unlikely. Well, how do you bargain with the future? Well, you give it what it wants. And you know, some of that's you maintain your social relationship and, you know, you make yourself useful to other people and you shape yourself so that you can cooperate with people and you don't act impulsively and maybe you squirrel something away for the next harvest even if you're hungry and, you know, and then the future isn't hell and you make the proper sacrifices. And so if you sacrifice to Kelly, then she turns into her opposite and showers benevolence on you. And that's Mother Nature, right? It's like, look out for Mother Nature, man. You know, 2 weeks out in the bush right now and you're dead, and it's not pleasant. And then if it's the spring, you last longer, but the bugs eat you, and so that's not very fun either. So nature, you know, it's bent on your destruction. But if you treat it properly and carefully and make the right sacrifices, then maybe one of her trees will offer you some fruit, and that would be okay. And so believe me, lots of people died trying to figure that out. You know nothing. What do? You establish a center. You explore from the center. It's a domain of safety, and that's surrounded by the unknown. So, and that's what children do. We already know this. If you watch how children explore, it's more evident if you look at children who are somewhat inhibited. Because really extroverted and emotionally stable children, they'll just explore, they won't recede. But children that are sort of balanced in their emotional response, imagine you bring a 18-month-old to a new playground. A mother's standing there, she's the pillar at the center of the world. Around her is explored territory. And the reason it's explored is because the child knows how to interact with the mother. And so one thing you want to know about kids is you can have multiple caregivers for your kids. You can have a nanny, you can put them in daycare, but they do not like having their primary caregiver switched. It's like everything transforms when that happens, and it destabilizes them badly. So if you're going to have other people take care of your kids, it's better that it's the same other person. Well, obviously, I mean, they're going to form an intimate and loving relationship with them with any luck, and if that disappears, it's like a death. But it's worse than that in some sense, or the reason that the death is bad, because the child's conceptual world, their familiar world, familiar, family, their familiar world collapses. So children hate that. Now they can bond to multiple people, that's not a problem. But they do not like having their caregivers shifted, because that defines their territory. So the child is adapted to the mother's presence and has been ever since birth, if everything's gone well. So it's a place of security and stability, partly because the child knows how to act around the mother, but also partly because if the child encounters anything that he or she doesn't understand while in the presence of mother, the mother will instantly intervene to provide the knowledge necessary to encapsulate the unexpected occurrence. Okay, so the child's by the mother, and maybe he's holding on, and that gives him ventral contact. It's comforting. It produces opiates. It decreases pain. It's directly comforting. And so then the child is maybe they're shy, and they're going to take a few looks at what's around first, and they're frozen, clinging to something secure. And then if nothing negative happens, they start to relax, just like a rat that's been put into a new cage. They start to relax, then they'll start to look. And that's the first manifestations of voluntary exploratory behavior. And maybe if there's other people around, they'll look and smile, and then they'll hide, right? And the smile is an invitation to play or interact. But so it's a foray out into the world. Smile, eye contact, then hide. Maybe they'll do that multiple times and get a game going. That establishes something stable going on between them and the stranger. Does the stranger know how to play? And then maybe they'll loosen up and they'll start to explore. And then they go out away from the mother and start interacting with the world until something happens that overwhelms them. Then they'll run back, get a hug, maybe have a sleep because maybe they've processed enough. And then you can encourage them to go back. And so what they're doing is they have the flag planted on an unknown territory. That's mom, the flag. Right? They circulate around there because it's secure. Make forays outwards where the dragons are. Gather what's of interest, and if it's too much, they run back. And then the mom says, it's okay, no problem, you know, or gives them a little, you know, rock, or maybe feeds them something, and lets them have a little rest, and then off you go, play again, out they go again. And so what the child is doing is continually moving out, extending its explored territory into the unknown, just like the Star Trek Voyagers, and then moving back to security, and then moving out farther, and then moving back to security. And hopefully at some point, they carry with them their own security. Once they become competent, right? Once you've incorporated all the competence of your parents, you don't need to go back. Well, and even if you do, it isn't going to help. You've transcended the security, and that's what makes you an adult. Hopefully that happens.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.